no dejaremos que cierren la linda puerta que siempre ha estado abierta a la vida.
This is Latin Radical with Warwick Fry in conjunction with Nimbin Community Radio 2 NIM FM. And today we're talking to Julie Webb, recently returned from a trip to Chiapas, the heartland of the Zapatista Revolution. Wellington, New Zealand, and Julie's just returned from 6 months in Mexico. How are you finding the conditions there in New Zealand after Mexico, Julie?
Freezing. absolutely freezing to the bone.
Yeah. So how long were you in Mexico?
Well, I was backwards and forwards between Mexico and Cuba since January 2006. So basically, I've probably been 7 or 8 months in Mexico in the last 18 months, maybe longer.
Yeah, and what took you there? Why did you actually go to Mexico?
Well, originally in January, I went as part as a special correspondent for Narco News on when La Otra Campaña, the Zapatista campaign, began on the 1st of January 2006 to go to every state in Mexico. Unlike other political campaigns, where politicians go and tell the people what they are going to do for them, the Zapatistas went on a campaign, that's why it's called the Other Campaign, to go and ask the people what their problems are and to get suggestions for what the solutions might be. That was a very interesting to me, that was a very interesting approach, and so I went to cover the beginning of the campaign.
Yeah, because I was under the impression the Zapatistas were mainly active in the southern part of Mexico, in Chiapas. So you're saying now that they are active or campaigning or being activists in all over Mexico now?
Yes, they are. There are Zapatista communities in DF, in Mexico City, in many different parts of Mexico. And there are also people that are not necessarily Zapatista communities, but that are bases of support for the Zapatistas, that support the Zapatista movement. For example, many of the organizations that are members of APO and Oaxaca also support the Zapatistas. Mm. And the Zapatistas in turn support APO and APPN, the Assembly of the Popular People's Assembly of Oaxaca and the Popular People's Assembly of Mexico, which are basically social organizations that have all grouped together to fight for the rights, for social justice, and for the rights of the downtrodden, of which there are many millions in Mexico.
In Oaxaca, apparently, this APA is it's like a parallel government. The people don't recognise the authority of the governor and have set up their own democratic institution.
Yes, and are based on the traditional indigenous forms of government, which is also how the Zapatistas are organised. They're autonomous communities that negotiate freely with other autonomous communities. And it's very much along the lines of participation. Everybody participates. Everybody has social responsibilities. And they all, instead of having, for example, an elected government, it's rotated, so everybody participates and has to have their turn. And if they do a bad job, then they get the really bad job, like cleaning latrines or whatever. So, you know, there is some incentive to perform well.
Yeah. And then you at one stage you ended up in Chiapas, which is like the home base of the Zapatistas. And I think every year or every 2 years they have a kind of a big gathering there, which includes international observers.
That's actually the first encuentro was in December, the first international one, and then the second one was in July. They haven't been a regular event. They were held because there has been, since 1994, when the Zapatista uprising occurred, and their issue and their problems became known to the world, they've received a lot of international support, and many groups in many different countries provide assistance to their communities, assist them with building schools and training, lots of training for training health promoters and education promoters. And so they had this encuentro because as they become more well known, people want to know how does this traditional form, how does the Zapatista way of life actually work? And so the encuentros are for the people from the international organisations and from other countries to come and actually see how they work, to see in the flesh rather than just read an article about their theories, to actually see it in practice. And the first one was in Oventique, and that was just in one place, and they just gave a lot of workshops. It was a bit like a conference. Whereas the second one, in July, we went to four different caracoles. Altogether, there are five in Chiapas, which have an average of about five municipalities within each caracol. And within each municipality, there's maybe another 30 or 40 communities, autonomous communities. So they're quite a... It was a really excellent opportunity in the last encuentro to see the different caracoles and how they work, and how there is quite a significant difference between just how far some of it advanced compared to others. I mean, now it's not by any means an even development. Mm. Some are far more advanced than others, which is possibly a reflection of the support that they've been able to get internationally for some, whereas others, it's just they're much poorer conditions and they may not have the time or the resources to build the sorts of infrastructures that the more successful or the more advanced ones have been able to do.
Could you just explain what a caracol is? It's obviously some kind of, it's like a grouping of autonomous communities. What does the Spanish word mean?
Yes, it's a grouping of autonomous communities. What they found was happening was that people would come from overseas and they'd go to a community and then they would think, oh, I'd like to help this community. And so they would donate money or they'd go back to their home communities and their little social organisation or church group or whatever it may be, and they'd raise money for that community. But so there was a very uneven development happening, and some communities were getting a lot of resources because they were relatively close to civilisation in terms of transport, and so it was easy for people from overseas to get to them, and so they were getting all the resources, whereas the more isolated communities were missing out. Mm. So these caracoles were formed basically with juntas, what they call juntas of bueno gobierno, which are of good government councils. And so every community has a representative on that council, and now anyone who has a project, idea or wants to help, this goes to the council and they decide where the biggest need is. And so they're trying to make sure that the resources are allocated more fairly now. And so basically that's sort of how the caracoles arose, and they also have a justice function. So they distribute things like the resources for health and education. They make sure that people are trained in all the communities, so that the aim is for every community to have its own micro health clinic with a trained health promoter, to have a school with a trained education promoter. And they also have justice systems using the traditional justice. And as a result of this, I've been so successful that, in fact, non-Zapatistas use their justice system as well. And quite often state authorities have been resorting to them over land disputes because people respect and abide by the decisions of the Zapatista justice system.
Mm.
It's more like a mediation-type system than a formal court where there are penalties, and they have, to us, what would seem very mild penalties, but to somebody who is living off the land, they're quite severe. For instance, a penalty for a first offence would be 24 hours in jail, followed by 2 days of community work. Now, for us, we think 2 days of community work might be a minor thing, but for them, that's 2 days out of the field of growing their food. So it actually has quite a significant impact.
Mm.
And then a second offence would be 48 hours jail and a few more days.
Mm.
And if somebody kills somebody, then they are responsible for the support of the victim's family for the rest of their life.
That's certainly natural justice. Mm. I said that's certainly natural justice, isn't it?
Yes. But it's all worked out. Like, the communities decide on the penalties, so they do vary between communities. But they decide on the penalties. Something that I think that people in Minden might find a bit difficult is the penalty for growing marijuana is banishment forever from all Zapatista communities, not only the community in which they live, but then every other community is also notified, and the person is banished. Because the problem of drugs coming from Colombia and up through Guatemala and up through Mexico to the United States is such a major problem, and the Zapatistas have enough attacks on their communities without being able to deal with if there were drugs in the communities, the federal authorities would just use that as an excuse to come in and wipe them out.
Yeah.
It's an absolutely very, very strong, strict rule.
Yeah. Well, that's
no
alcohol either. And you actually went out and lived on one of these communities that was having some difficulty. Apparently, not everyone was happy with being autonomous. Is that right? You went to the Emiliano Zapata community, or?
Yes, I've actually been a human rights observer in three communities in Chiapas. Two Zapatista communities and one non-Zapatista community that has a lot of paramilitary activity. The idea of the Human Rights Observers Program is that by having international observers living in a community, it may deter the people from attacking them. And this, to a large extent, it has been very successful in preventing attacks. The communities that I've been in, I was in Nuevo San Pedro, that was the first one, and there was not very much happening. It was during the red alert, so there was not, because the communities had basically shut down and there were no foreigners allowed, there was not very much activity at all.
This was a red alert. They shut the access down. Now, what is a red alert about? What happens to call a red alert?
That red alert was called following the attack on the town of Atenco, San Salvador Atenco, where the federal police just went in and took over an entire town, raped and sexually assaulted something like 46 women and detained them, detained hundreds of people without warrants, without any form of charges. The flower sellers went to open their stalls early in the morning and on the 3rd of May, and the federal police just went in and started smashing up their stalls, and the people of the town came out to support them and from a nearby town, and it turned into just a great big free-for-all. And then the local police called in the federal police, municipal police, and they came in. A young boy, a 14-year-old boy, was killed, and then the next morning, so many people came from Mexico City to, you know, when they heard what was going on, to come in, out and support unions, sent their union members out to support the people. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, the next morning, the federal police just came in with 4,000 troops and just basically rampaged the town and grabbed everybody, anybody and everybody off the street, entered houses, dragged people out of their houses, raped and sexually assaulted women. There have been numerous human rights reports, both the Mexican National Commission of Human Rights as well as other international human rights bodies have all found that there were gross abuses, rapes, sexual assaults. But of course, nobody has been charged for any of those. But as a result of that, it was quite clear that there was a massive repression, state repression happening. And so these Zapatistas, the people that were attacked in Atenco had provided the guard of honour for the other campaign on the 1st of May, 2 days earlier. And so it was perceived, that attack was perceived as very much an attack on the Zapatistas and the EZLN, and so a red alert was called, and all foreigners were expelled from all their communities, and basically went into high, you know, danger mode.
Wow.
And it was basically because there were elections due in July, and the other campaign was actually having an enormous impact throughout the country, and people were being very, the politicians were basically worried at the support that was very manifest for the EZLN.
Mm. And well, you're very lucky to be one of the foreigners to observe, be an observer on one of these communities. How did you find it living there? What were the conditions like?
They're very, very, very basic. You live better than the local people because we have the ability to buy food and take it in with us, because you go in for 2 weeks at a time, sometimes a month, whereas they live there all day, every day, and they are totally subsistent. So, for instance, the house, the shelter that we live in, has dirt floors. Your bed, I collected some rocks from the field and some bits of wood and made myself a bed, because, which was just some planks on resting on some rocks, because I didn't fare too well sleeping in a hammock, which is what most people do sleep in. You cook on a fire, so you get up, collect the wood. You chop the wood with a machete. There wasn't even an axe. Machetes are used for everything. And so your day is very much get up in the morning, chop the wood, make the fire to boil the water for your coffee. They bring tortillas. They provide tortillas. The communities provide the observers with tortillas, but the rest of your food you have to provide yourself. So basically it's beans and rice, because that's all there is. And but I bought spices in the spice shop before I went in, so that at least I had beans and rice with different flavours.
Yeah.
But yes, and you bathe in the river, you wash your clothes in the river. It's very, there is a tap for drinking water, and in fact, in two of the communities, the drinking water was from springs and was absolutely pure and beautiful. But in the other community, that was the non-Zapatista community, that was from a river that was very polluted because everybody's using the same river. They're washing in it, they're doing everything in it, and then the tap came up from that river, so it was very dirty, and you had to boil the water and use drops and do all that, purify it. I found that the non-Zapatista community actually had far worse conditions. The Zapatistas are organized and they work collectively and they help each other, and they help each other build a house, they help each other build latrines. They have a far more organized community than the other one that I was in, where it was half paramilitary and the other half were Zapatista supporters, but they couldn't be open about it. A lot of them had been driven out. In front, the house that we were in was like 5 yards from the house of a man who we were basically protecting. The house in front had been burned down, the house behind had been burned down, something like about 30 families had been driven out. Displacement, they call it, because it's not even the people that live there, it's they're being paid by a rich landowner on the other side of the highway who wants that land, and so basically he pays other villagers to attack their fellow villagers, who are often relatives, to drive them out so that then he can take the land. And they paid him a very, $1,000, $2,000. And these people are so poor that to them that is, a fortune. And so they will take that money and attack their cousin or their brother and drive them out just for this very, what we would consider a pittance, but to them is a fortune.
That's one of the effects of huge discrepancies in income and wealth, I suppose. To the landowner, $1,000 is not even a week's interest in the thing. That's extraordinary.
Well, and one of the problems is that it's often collectively owned land. There's things called ejidos, which is collectively owned land. So an individual cannot sell it. But if they can drive the people off, the ones who don't want to sell off, then the ones that are left then can sell it together to these people. And it's usually because there are valuable resources like hardwood forests. There's very valuable hardwood forests. There's waterfalls. There's water. Water is the new gold. Mm-hmm. And much of the water is in indigenous territory, and it's under huge pressure right now. I mean, there's transnationals in there. Coca-Cola is in their boots and all. And, it's in some communities, the only water you can get, you have to buy, and it's made by Coca-Cola.
So I guess the international observers and the international support is critical, because, I mean, even though the Zapatistas started off as an armed struggle, they almost invariably try to use non-violent means. I was just thinking, these people being forced out of their dwellings and off their land, it's probably critical that people like you be there. Are there other non-violent tactics that the Zapatistas can use to protect their people?
Well, mainly it is just through international solidarity. I mean, there was the attack on the 25th of August in the Monte Azulis area, where 39 families were displaced, 6 heads of families are in jail, and Amnesty International in Switzerland has just presented demands to the Mexican government that they release these people And this was, they were just driven off their land. They'd been there for over 30 years, but there was no, they were not served with an eviction notice. There were no apprehension orders. There were no formal charges. They're just being, the men are in jail. The women, they came in with helicopters. Pregnant women were forced onto helicopters. People, ill people. It's just absolutely horrendous. And then there's just been another one on the September the 12th, which is, you know, a couple of days ago, in San Jeronimo, where at the Blue Waters, Agua Azul waterfall, which is a tourist attraction, where another situation where the Zapatistas and the non-Zapatistas had a confrontation, and which ended with two Zapatistas with stab wounds. And on Wednesday, there was a non-aggression pact signed between the state authorities and the EZLN. But, yeah, the EZLN basically use solidarity. They are only armed in defence. Since the armed uprising in 1994, they have not taken up arms in aggression. They denounce the use of armed force some 14 days after the uprising. So, yes, yeah, so it's very much a peaceful movement. And they say that they've been in resistance for 500 years, and so, you know, they're prepared to keep on going for another 500 if necessary.
And
many are killed along the way.
The
commitment to peaceful, to peace, to peaceful change is absolutely non-negotiable. And that is something like with APO in Oaxaca and in the other areas, the Zapatistas have remained absolutely committed to non-violent power.
That's extraordinary level of morale. And for a long time, the subcomandante Marcos was, he calls himself the subcomandante because he says the people lead him, he doesn't lead the people. He's been a very articulate spokesperson for the Zapatistas ever since the 1994 uprising. Now, you sent us some terrific material from the last encuentro, including a couple of speeches by or talks by Subcomandante Marcos. Now, did you actually meet him personally, and what were your impressions of him?
Well, I haven't met him personally, as in being introduced, but taking photos and recording and being, reporting, being media, I have had, I could have touched him if I wasn't taking photos. but yes, I've been very close to him, but I haven't actually had a conversation with him or anything like that. But I have heard him speak and seen him interact with many people. And he is a very, very personable, he's a very nice guy. Like, that's what you would describe him as. He's a really nice guy. And he listens, and he's funny, and he's sensitive, and he, he's just a really genuine person, a warm, genuine human being. That's what comes across. I mean, he's like the son every mother would like to have. And he's obviously also the boyfriend every woman would like to have, judging by his enormous following of females. He's a really genuine person who, with sensitivity, humour, and a very intelligent and very thoughtful and very nice person. And he's always got kids around him. Like, he relates to everybody. At one, when I was taking photos at one event, there were nuns lined up next to me, pressing forward for a glimpse, he just appeals to everybody because he's a really nice person. He listens, he listens, and he tells very funny stories, and so everybody, but he's, so also do the other commandantes. I mean, there's, at the encuentro, one of them did this dance, this song and dancing, a bit like, put your left leg in, put your left leg out Spanish type version of that. And I mean, you just would never see somebody like Helen Clark or John Howard do something like that at the end of a speech, you know, and have the whole audience dancing and singing. It was just absolutely wonderful. But, you know, they're just real. They're real people. It's the thing of being from below, you know.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, so I think the appeal of not only Marcos, but also the other comandantes, is that they are of the people, and they are very much equals, and they are approachable, and they know how what people's lives are like, and they, you know, they have empathy, and they have this incredible sensitivity to other people, which is what it's all about: respect, and you know, respect for each other. Mm. So yeah, it's. When you meet them, it's easy to see why that style of life, why that style of living is so much desired, because it really is a transformation in the way people relate to each other. I mean, that is what really strikes you from coming from another, from the first world into. That is just, it's a whole different way of relating.
Yeah, and I guess now you're back in the first world. What are your plans, your immediate plans?
Well, my immediate plans are to raise funds for the health services in Chiapas, because for the Zapatista health services, because they have very many remote communities with very little access to healthcare, and they desperately need, at the moment, it's training in basic first aid, you know, things that they can be independent as much as possible, health promotion and prevention, reproductive health, to train people in the communities to be able to provide their own health services as much as possible. And so a lot of capacitation, a lot of training is needed. And so we're raising funds to assist with that. And I hope to go back. There's a women's encuentro in December, and that's where the Zapatista women will be meeting with the women of the world to look at specific women's issues. And of which there are many. They have a whole set of their own problems. I mean, they have to give birth in the middle of nowhere with no access to emergency services. There's a high rate of neonatal and maternal deaths. You know, there's a lot of problems, and there's a lot of solutions that they will be generating,
yeah.
I'm sure, in December.
Yeah.
So that's my priority, is to raise money and then go back in December. And I would also, there's also a upsurge of attacks against the communities. They're just gathering in force. It's as if there's a very definite surge to try to wipe out the Zapatistas from Chiapas because of their presence in the lands of lots of resources like the forests and the waters, which the transnationals want. And so there's a big need for people to be there and to help protect those resources from encroaching paramilitaries under the command of big business.
A bit like the surge on the recent surge in the Aboriginal communities here in Australia. But,
yes.
I'm quite interested to hear that there is an encuentro specifically for women, because when I was there in 1997, there was the commandantes weren't just men. There were some very prominent and well-known and charismatic women, Zapatista commandantes. Did you meet any of the women leaders?
I've been to many events at which they've been. Usually there's always women commandantes up there with the men commandantes, and they always give their speeches, and there's a big women presence, but probably not as much as we would have. I mean, it's certainly not 50%, but they're getting there, and that's what this Nguyenthra on December is about, you know, moving towards getting women into all levels of all undertakings, because it's very difficult. I mean, there's the cultural barriers as well as just the barriers of daily life, because the daily life is so tough that, in fact, you know, women spend from 5 a.m. till 9 p.m. working their butts off. And so there's just surviving, cooking, cleaning, you know, doing that, working in the milker. So it's a real challenge to do a lot of, to get out to train as a health promoter or an education promoter or something else when you're just surviving by the day. But actually, with regard to the Indigenous, there's a huge Nguyenthra in October in Sonola in Mexico, which the Zapatistas are promoting, the Yaqui people. And I hope that some Aboriginal people will be able to get to that Nguyenthra, because people are coming from the entire South America, Latin America, the entire continent will all be going to that Nguyenthra. And I think it's a really important Nguyenthra for Indigenous peoples. People are coming from Canada, you know, from the entire Americas. And I think it would be great if some Aboriginal people could get to that Nguyenthra and link in with the struggle and make known their struggle as well to the people, the Indigenous people of the Americas, because there's not a lot of knowledge, between the non-English, non-Spanish-speaking Indigenous people, I think people are don't have very much knowledge at all about the situation of Australian Indigenous people, and it would be a very valuable meeting.
Yeah, well,
I think.
Well, thanks for bringing that to us to our attention, Julie. That would be something perhaps that activists here in Australia can work on. If someone like Sam Watson or could go over there, that would be terrific.
It would. Yes.
Yeah. Look, well, thanks very much for giving us your time, Julie. Just before you go, your fundraising activities, is there anything here in Australia that could be done, you know, perhaps Green Left Weekly, or are there any, do you have any links with the Australian people who could help with the fundraising?
Well, we are hoping to have a raffle. I've only just got back and hit the ground, and I have to check out all the legals regarding that. And it's a bit complicated. I've done a bit by internet, and it's sort of, so now I'm thinking, oh, maybe it might be easier just to do something on eBay. But we do have a copy of the Subcomandante Marcos's latest novel. It's an erotic novel. It's very large, it's sort of coffee table sized, illustrated by one of the leading Mexican artists. It's an absolutely beautiful publication. And Subcomandante Marcos signed it. So it's an autographed copy of his novel. And there were only 2,000 printed of this book, so it's a very much a collector's item. And so that we are using that to raise funds for the health services. So if it ends up being a raffle or whatever form it ends up, we'd certainly like to make it available to the Australian public to also participate in fundraising for this. And who knows, they might win themselves one of only 2,000, and probably one of only a handful of actual autographed copies of this novel, which is an absolutely beautiful book on its own, let alone with out the wonderful signature in the front.
Yeah, I saw some of the. Yeah, that. Oh man, yeah, that's something I'd love to have on my coffee table. Yeah, if I had a coffee table.
It's in Spanish. That's the only detraction. But
that's
the
all
pictures
right.
are wonderful.
Yeah.
So, in fact, I'll let you know. What happens with that and if we are going to make tickets available in Australia so that listeners can participate.
I'll certainly let them know if that happens, Julie, and thanks very much for talking to Toonim FM.
Great. Okay, it was great to talk to you.
No dejaremos que cierren la linda puerta que siempre ha estado abierta a la vida.